Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
G'day and welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Gabrielle Knipe and today marks the final episode in our special series on the Women in National Security Conference. This one wasn't originally planned, but we thought it would be an oversight not to devote a podcast to the amazing story of the Woodjil Woodjil Security Songlines. 2 years ago in Far North Queensland, an Indigenous community initiative to build human security found a willing partner in the local army unit. The Woodjil Woodjil community has been working with the 51st Battalion of the Far North Queensland Regiment of the Australian Army ever since. Eileen Demal Hall is the Chief Executive Officer of the Woodjil Woodjil Aboriginal Shire Council in the Daintree Rainforest area of Cape York. Tim Rutherford is the Commanding Officer of the 51st Battalion, a long-range reconnaissance unit based in Cairns, who has been responsible for leading the Army's surveillance forces assigned to Operation Resolute. They were joined by Jay Caldwell, Director of Professional Studies, and Jacinta Carroll, Director of National Security Policy at the National Security College, and convener of the Women in National Security Conference. Eileen, Tim, Jacinta and Jay had a great chat. So without further ado, here they are.
Hi, I'm Jacinta Carroll, Director National Security Policy at the National Security College.
Hi, I'm Jay Caldwell, the Director of Professional and Executive Development at the National Security College. And today we're joined by a couple of colleagues who've been here for the Women in National Security Conference. Lieutenant Colonel Tim Rutherford, the Commanding Officer for 51st Regiment, Far North Queensland Regiment, and Eileen Demal Hall, who's the CEO of the Woodjil Woodjil Aboriginal Shire Council. Welcome.
Thank you.
We were really pleased to have you along as part of our Women in National Security Conference, and you told us a fascinating story, and it's a story you've been we've been involved in since the start of the year. I might throw to you for a start, to Eileen, in terms of saying how did this relationship, this working together that you've had between the Woodjil Woodjil community and 51st Far North Queensland Regiment, how did it start? How did it kick off?
I might actually throw it to Brother Tim, because he's actually got how we're actually going to yarn, because it's quite an interesting story.
Yeah.
So,
Tim.
First of all, Woodjil Woodjil, we need to understand what it is. Yeah. And it's a community, the smallest or second smallest Aboriginal Shire Council in Australia. It's 68.9 hectares and located on the northern edge of the Daintree Rainforest. So 4.5 hours drive from Cairns on a four-wheel drive track that's seasonal, that requires you to cross multiple rivers and also get the Daintree River ferry. So in best conditions, you can drive there, most hours of the day. But it's the northern tropics, so it's not always best conditions. And that means that not only is it 4.5 hours drive if you can get there, it can be disconnected at any time. Cyclone events, any sort of heavy rain, you name it. So Woodjil Woodjil, this tiny little community, is about as isolated as you get in Australia, even though it's kind of proximal to Cairns. That has a whole bunch of so what's that flow from it. At the moment, the council and Eileen will speak to shortly, but its population strength is 283 people on paper by the census. But we know through a couple of different independent audits that the numbers are out, and it's about 683 people. It's an Aboriginal Shire Council, and so it doesn't have a rates base to draw income. It's reliant on grants. And at the moment, if the data isn't accurate, and everything suggests it's not, that the grants are coming through with about a third of the funding required to do business. So the problems end up being twofold. It's isolated and seasonal access, And second, that the resources don't match the requirements. So we have a capacity issue.
Mm. And the interesting thing with Woodjal Woodjal is we also have had to purchase, because we're so overcrowded and such a small shire, we've actually had to purchase freehold blocks across to other shires, so to the north in Cookshire in a place called Ayton, and also to the south into Douglas Shire. So what that actually means is I've now also increased my service delivery reach across three shires. But yet under census, I'm only recognised within the town footprint itself. So, you know, logistically that creates a bit of an issue too, especially during wet season, because we get cut off to the north, to the south, and especially now with the changes in the weather conditions we're noticing, even through the middle of the town. So we're getting, you know, within a short few hours, we're getting heavy rainfall, which is creating a lot of flash flooding. And mix that up with cyclones and then also bushfires during dry season. You know, it's all I'm waiting for is a plague of locusts sort of to come through, you know.
You get the whole pick there.
Yeah, get the whole thing, you know. Come on, Moses. So one of the other things that, and for your listeners out there, the difference between us and mainstream, like Brother Tim touched on, is we do a lot of womb-to-tomb stuff. We deliver kindy as well as right through the whole spectrum to help people bury their loved ones. We also play in the social services space, which is a legacy issue. So we deliver community banking, community post office, Indigenous Knowledge Centre, which is like our library, radio station. We also deliver disability and hack-related type services, not only to community mob but also to non-Indigenous people across the three shires. So we're quite broad, but our dollar is very small. So a lot of the metrics they use is population, and also for some of us in local government, it's road network. Well, if you're only 68.9 hectares, both those metrics are out.
Can we maybe go back 2 years? Because one thing that's really struck me and Jay, and we might just say for the podcast that we're all here because you phoned the National Security College to say we're in an area in far north Queensland where border security is an issue. There are a whole range of other security issues that you're being asked about, but you thought, well, we need to find out more about that. So contacted a training establishment that does that. We don't normally look at this space, but we're quite struck. We met you and we heard this extraordinary story of what had happened in the last 2 years, which isn't much time. I mean, could you tell us about what you found when you were there? And I think for a bit of contrast, it might be nice, Tim, if you could say what you thought you would normally do when you came in as the commander of an army regiment and where this little isolated community would normally have fitted into your view of the world.
So I started in on August the 15th, 2016, first time CEO for Woodjal Woodjal Aboriginal Shire Council. For your listeners, I have an Aboriginal mother and an Irish father, but I actually grew up north of there, an hour and a half north at a place called Hopevale. So that's a Lutheran mission, as is Woodjal Woodjal. 2 years ago, Woodjal Woodjal, and I'll be honest, was struggling as a community. We had a lot of issues around domestic violence. We also had a lot of issues that I didn't realise at the time was unresolved trauma, you know, generational trauma and family trauma that we really, as a community, hadn't healed from. There was an incident that had involved a partner, a man and a woman partner. The female partner was medevaced out. Actually, I sort of remembered now, we actually, within a two-week period, we had 10 evacs out within a two-week period because of issues around domestic violence. So we were really struggling. The last incident, the lady almost lost her life. So we were in a really bad state. I didn't myself personally have the skill sets to deal with it. The counsellors, because they were culture way, they were related to both sides of the big family. We had had a murder that had happened 12, 13 years before, but no one had received trauma counselling, you know, because of that event. So there was a lot of issues there. That particular incident triggered almost a riot in the community. Woodjal Woodjal itself is a quiet community, unlike other parts of Cape York. You know, some mob, they'll go off straight away. Our mob, you know, quiet. So when a quiet mob go off, you know, there's serious issues there. So when you get into a situation where mob are struggling, You only had that small window of opportunity to try and get some support in. At that time too, within Cape York, we also had the issue that was happening at our other Cape community called Kawanyama. So where a man had driven his Toyota into in-law's house and several people had died. So a lot of the counselling and counselling services, health practitioners were actually up that way. So I really had to sort of hunt around fast to get some support. Our Ministerial Champions office, you know, which was the city, they called back then, Science, Innovation, Technology, they were trying to find some support from a Brisbane context, but really I needed help straight away. So came across Brother Tim White, who's Dr. Tim White, who runs a program called Kapani. I actually invited him up and said, Brother, I need help. I need to help community. Can you work with our men so I can work with the women? And just, yeah, and yeah. Yeah,
so and there's an army link with Dr. White as well, isn't there, that's interesting?
Yeah, so Tim White, he was a soldier in 1st Battalion in Somalia and had left army and gone and studied psychology and then moved into the police force and had established himself on tropical North Queensland working in, you know, for example, negotiating the Palm Island riots and some other things. So he had experience in working in troubled Indigenous communities. But importantly, you know, Tim and his team, Kapani, are formed around a bunch of ex-veterans. And their business model or their program is to instill military-style values, courage, initiative, respect, teamwork, into new communities or troubled communities. Now, I say army values, military values. Really, they're just good human values, you know. And so Tim's role there was to help work with community to teach some of the folk how to manage their anger. And as Eileen has put a couple of times through the conference, you know, the unexpecteds fell out from that. Trauma recognises trauma. And whilst it wasn't apparent to the Kapani lads at the time when they stepped foot in community, they were carrying some baggage from their previous deployments. And when they started working with the young men, there was a resonance between them. That created a bond and they were able to open up, and we saw some really terrific results from that. I guess that put the first step into community as far as help went for Woodja Woodja. Up to that point, it's this isolated speck on the northern Daintree trying to do everything itself, and capacity was its biggest issue. Now, I'm, you know, CO 51. You know, my mandate isn't social services. We're a regional force surveillance unit. We're one of three, North Force and the Pilbara. And my mandate is to do the clandestine surveillance in support of the whole of government approach to border protection.
Can I just say in there, Tim, as well, that makes you an operational unit of the Australian Defence Force operating within Australia. So quite an unusual role, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, it's funny, we talk about defence, you know, perhaps not willingly, but defence is a binary organisation, Army in particular. You're a full-time organisation or you're part-time. You're deployed on operations and we think Middle East or near region. Or you're at home and you're training. Well, I'm this blended thing. And so we sit outside of the conventional force. We'd call ourselves probably non-traditional as a label, but I have more full-time staff than any part-time unit, and my part-timers do more part-time work than any part-time unit. And I've got to, you know, we balance that. But importantly for me, I have to recruit a workforce regionally in very remote communities to generate my surveillance teams to go and be tasked by Maritime Border Command to do the vectoring for, you know, the prescribed threats we work against. So my problem, different to Eileen's, Eileen's has got this capacity issue inside community. She needs capacity to manage the isolation and all of the tasks that she needs to do. My mandate is I need to do border protection. And so my challenge is I need to get a workforce that I can recruit. And this is where Kapani, Woodja Woodja and 51 start to all overlap. I know Tim White, and we'd been talking, and he'd been telling me about what he's doing up in community. I'm looking to venture into new communities. For quite a while, the RFSUs have sort of fallen back onto what they know, and that is recruiting in the metropole, and they're recruiting, you know, relatively educated folk from the bigger cities.
So recruiting on similar to the recruitment model of normal army.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And as a non-traditional unit, that's not what we're about. And, RFSUs, it's recognised we work in remote regional Australia and that our workforce isn't the same as everywhere. And the recognition is the three RFSU commanders have a whole lot of dispensations that we can apply to recruit a workforce. So we can waive criminal records, we can waive medical education within reason.
Yeah, based on your judgment of...
Exactly, yeah. So the reason's not really prescribed. And in this binary world of army, our policy's binary. And being a 0.5, the policy doesn't always apply to us. So there's a lot of judgment that we have to exercise. And, you know, inside of that, there's a lot of opportunity. I guess, you know, to put up front that the guy who formed the RFSU, or the model way back when, Second World War, Nakaroos, a guy called Stanner, he referred to the RFSUs as a light horse organisation with commando tendencies. And the thing that gives me great comfort at the moment is, you know, it's a light horse guy running one of the three, and the other two are run by commandos at the moment. So we've got the right level of non-traditional or unconventional thought being applied. And so my mandate was coming out of Afghanistan, where I'd been the chief of operational plans for southern Afghanistan in the Americans. I saw Cape York in much the same light, and it was only because I'd had a week between leaving Afghanistan and arriving on Cape York and taking over the job. So my brain was still very much on how do you solve problems in Kandahar, or, you know, what are we going to go and do in Helmand type thing. And the first thing is you need to understand the human terrain, and you need to get out and amongst the people. And that doctrine, you know, that way of operating, it's not just something that you can do in a kinetic operation. And we've heard throughout the WINS conference, and it's a great conference that I really commend, the use of hard power is a sometimes food. Soft power is much more important. And it's economy of force. A few dollars spent influencing people can save hundreds of dollars spent using the harder edge of what we can do. And so we took that approach, and the mandate that I gave to my team was we need to recruit a workforce. We need to get out of the main cities. We need to get back into community, but you need to build trust. And you do that through time, and you do that through not asking anything of someone, but giving first. And through that trust, things will come. So we'd be patient, patience and effort. And that's where the Tim White piece came in. Just as Tim was in community, my team first arrived, and that was Josh Mickle.
So I just started first time CEO, then got the great news that our community hall doesn't meet code, so I don't actually have a place of refuge to evacuate people to.
And
it seems from, quite significant in Hurricane Alley.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jay and I've been welcomed by you in community and to the battalion. And I think we remember that it's a question of how many buildings in the community meet code as well as other challenges.
Not many, sister. Not many. So that's, you know, for your listeners out there, that that keeps me up at night, particularly during wet season. So we had a situation early last year, and that was around the same time that Brother Josh had started. You know, coming through Brother Josh Mickle.
Josh is Major Josh
Mickle. Yeah, sorry. Yes,
who's the commander of Officer Commanding Alpha Company in your battalion, working to you, Tim.
Yeah. So for the listeners, they're brothers. So what we didn't realise through our relationship connection with community and 51st Battalion was that we actually had a song line that linked us back five generations before with two senior elders. Norman and Charlie Baird, who went from the Bloomfield River Mission, which was the first mission in community, to World War One, they were there at Egypt. They were there at the Western Front, survived, came back. We have a saying back home: if you eat from the same plate, they family. Because if I don't trust you, I won't eat with you. I don't want to eat your badness. Western Cape York, for those of you that don't know, they don't actually have a word. For friend, you either family or you stranger. So if I can't place you in the cultural kinship system as family, I can't have you as friend. You're a stranger. So, you know, historically we have a number of agencies that have bad blood, bad history, unfortunately, with some of our Western Cape communities. So they're automatically going to have that culture clash. Eastern Cape York is different. We don't have a word so much for stranger. It's more jawon or dawon, which is friend of your wawu, friend of your spirit, and family. So even if you're mongrel, we'll still put you in that family kinship.
So Jay and I were welcome.
Yeah. Even though you're mongrel. No, I lie. So part of our journey has been reconnecting with the footsteps of them two ajis, them two old fellas, and then realizing that our family, we had this beautiful, vibrant history that we had forgotten. So part of the journey too was while we were still trying to build capacity within community, we were just also rediscovering who we were as a community and what was important. We had gone through, we had heavy rain early last year, and March in particular, we were cut off for nearly 2 weeks.
That's in 2017.
And it became really apparent I didn't have the bench strength within community to deal with issues around resilience or disaster. As a local government, under the Local Government Act, we are responsible for disaster management. So when we started working with our brothers and sisters from 51st Battalion and also the work, the pre-work with Dr. Tim White, we thought, okay, here's an opportunity where we can learn some skills, valuable skills from 51st Battalion through the Army Reserve training. It had actually been 100 years. I actually signed up for Army Reserves.
So the CEO of the Shire Council said, I'm going to walk the talk.
Let's do this. And I did it.
And what was that like?
You know what? I you know, some of my other colleagues, peers, were like, Eileen, what are you doing? You know, you don't have time for this. August is a bad month to be doing anything because you're preparing for audits and all the rest of it. But I really wanted to understand the training that, you know, what is Army Reserves? When I first met Brother Josh, Major Mickle, I vividly remember the yarn. He was explaining, you know, all the attributes that Army Reserve training can give.
And he'd driven down the Bloomfield track and stopped in at Woodjal Woodjal.
And he wasn't meaning to. He was on his way to Cooktown to the base that they had there. And
because you hadn't had any real contact with Army since the First World War.
There was a visit that had been 12 years before, and it was really funny because community remembered who came, how many trucks there were. So, you know, it was, they were hungry for it but just didn't know how to reach out. So, and Brother Josh was talking about all these attributes. And I said, Brother, how do I yarn this to countrymen? What is it that you believe in? And the word was motto. What is your motto? And he said, love of country leads me. Bingo. As soon as he said that, I can work with that, because what do countrymen believe is caring for country, love of country, everything they do, connecting to country.
So this is the battalion motto.
Yo means yes. and it resonated. And when we started talking, and the other thing too we sort of haven't spoken about was that them elders, especially the women elders, our church elders, had actually prayed for Army to come to help. They didn't come out till much later. So, you know, everything happened for a reason. Brother X is not X. You are Cav, you know, Calvary. I'm sorry, I'm a bit tongue-tied. So was one of the Ajis. So, you know, that full circle for us. So
is that rare historical link? So the 51st is, it's an infantry battalion. I'm a light horse guy. Had been a captain's pick to sort of come in. And so that unruffled a few feathers in the conventional sort of side of the battalion. But most people saw it as, you know, it's an okay step for community, because the last Woodjal Woodjal soldier, Charlie Baird, was from the 11th Light Horse. And all of a sudden, after 102 years, there's a Light Horse guy running 51 and they're driving through town. There was this immediate connection. And so the song line that had been largely forgotten started to reconnect. And I guess, you know, if we step through that, we had the, you know, my mandate is I'm looking for a workforce, and you know, sisters looking for capacity to just survive. But the capacity isn't available to her because the people in community are troubled, and they're cooking off. And for me, the workforce where I'm leading to in these communities, we just haven't been there for a long time. And so, you know, the nexus is that we've got Kapani that come in to help heal community. And as a spin-off, they're getting people sort of job ready for me to come and look at in detail to say you're probably eligible to come through training. The other great power that Julie Bishop mentioned when she kicked off the WINS conference this week was the power of ideas. And it's a fantastic sentiment. And it got me to thinking, and really what the power of ideas is enabled by is a tolerance for risk. And now we get into, you know, the RFSUs being non-traditional. We've got a mandate that is huge. You know, North Force is 1.8 million square kilometres. The Pilbara, 1.4 million square kilometres. I'm 650,000, but I've got the Torres Strait where there's nothing but islands and ocean.
And right up to the Papua New Guinea mainland.
Yeah, that's right. You can from Saibai, it's like looking over Lake Burley Griffin, you know, there's PNG. And so we need to be more comfortable in accepting risk. And I think part of having a light horse guy here and the commandos in the other regiment is we have a greater appetite for it. And so when it came into, okay, I need to build capacity. Now, at this point, we're not thinking of, you know, the great things that we've seen happen. We're strictly in our lanes of Eileen's wanting to solve her capacity issue and I'm trying to just find a workforce. And so we went through the stages of Kapani and training people, and we realised this is a good workforce, and these other skills started to spill into the social atmosphere, which was raising the capacity there. Now, as it turned out, we skip ahead a little bit of time. You know, we managed to go from nothing to there's about 10% of the community have now been trained as members of the 51st and doing operational patrols and have got a whole bunch of different skills.
Can I just jump in there? 10% of a community are active members of an Army Reserve unit that is operating at around four times the level of a standard Army Reserve unit. Is this... That's an extraordinary impact, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if resourcing is the metric we use, then, you know, we are employing our people about four times as much as the average part-time soldier.
But a big part of this small community.
Huge.
Huge.
Including the CEO.
Yes.
Are there any other examples at that scale, Tim, in terms of the numbers in the community?
No. And I guess what makes, for me, the Woojil Woojil story so special is that, first of all, there was this great confluence of a military songline, the 102 years of proud history of the 51st, that somehow wove into and then became fused with this brilliant Indigenous cultural songline, and it just cooked off. And for the longest time, and until we met you, actually, Eileen and I...
Yeah. I think we were found.
Happily
found.
And so I think until we sat down and we were talking through it all, for us it was business as usual. We didn't realise that there was anything happening here. But then we began to reflect more and more on it, and we began to discover, hey, there are some things here that we didn't anticipate. And in the social capacity building space, you know, one of the big things was community was healing. You know, that people were getting pride and respect back. They're getting employment. They're being challenged, but they're also being given skills and opportunity. And that's pretty major. One of the great examples we saw, I mean, the statistics speak one way. And, you know, so we saw a 61% drop in public nuisance. We saw a 31% drop of domestic violence. So here we had a community that was in the top 10 for domestic violence in Australia, is now outside the top 10 in about a year-long period. I mean, that's remarkable. And you know, we won't go into some of the stories of DV, but it's not a pleasant subject. And to eradicate a third of it in a year, that's huge.
And 61% of public nuisance criminal rates.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, when, you know, and when mob would go off, that would impact on service delivery because staff wouldn't turn up because they don't feel safe to come to work because of all that family fighting. So for me, it was a real issue. You know, and then when we talk about because we have Work for the Dole program, CDP, how do you give opportunity for mob that have generational unemployment? So, you know, if Brother Tim here turns up to me, the employer, you know, first question I'm going to ask him as a prospective employee. So, Tim, can you tell me about any experience that you might have? Well, if he's generationally unemployed in a remote community, it's very hard for him to gain any experience. He might have done enough certifications, certificate 1, 2, 3. He might have done a stint, you know, as a placement somewhere else. But, you know, when they start doing Army Reserve training, the skill sets that they develop from that, I can easily transfer across into SES and other government, local government related fields. Something simple as navigation, them learning how to read a map, fits in perfectly in terms of, you know, civil works and construction, you know, like for road network. That's, so it's how you adapt that and, you know.
So your workforce participation went up as well. So,
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and we found that the people who hadn't done the training with us, you know, their participation rate's about 30-35%.
Yep.
And anyone who went through the training, even if they didn't decide to continue to serve, they just did the training, it's about 86%.
Yep. As like unheard of, you know, unheard of.
Yeah, and any community would be proud of those numbers.
Oh, yeah.
That turnaround, whether it's in relation to crime or in relation to employment.
Yeah, in such a short time, you know. And the bizarre thing is you look at other areas where they have so much money invested to reduce things, and here we were. I'd like to say that we were strategic in how we approached this, but like Brother said, it was like
bit of bottom up, top down.
Yeah.
We can say it's top down.
Like that.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
I mean, there are a thousand good anecdotes, and you know, we generally don't have time to really go through them all. The one that sticks out in this, you know, the social capacity building was Neil. So Neil, he didn't get through the recruiting process. And even with the waivers I have, there were things that were going to stop him. And it was fortunate that at that third party, Kapani, had several months in community and they were trained psychologists and they could provide a recommendation that I could then go and use. Mm. And so we got Neil over the line on the bones of his...
So based on their assessment of being up close and seeing him.
Yeah, their reference. And we were able to change a few things and use every waiver that we could to get him in the door. And then we had a great straight-up chat with Neil and said, Neil's pretty rough, you know. He's that kid that's got the scruffy beard, you know, the oversized shirt, thinks he's a gangster and wears a beanie in the Daintree rainforest when it's 32 degrees. You know, you probably don't need the beanie, brother. and so I had this yarn with him and I said, mate, you've failed. But I'm going to let you in.
Mm.
I'm going to give you an opportunity because I know that if we don't change, then nothing will change with you. And so don't let me down. And it wasn't that he didn't want to let me down, but he had a reason, I think. And you know, we've talked about it a lot since. But Neil went on to top his courses and he was doing fantastic work. Neil is largely illiterate. But he's an influencer in community, you know, and wherever he went, there was a pack of kids that would go with him. And so Neil now sees himself as this role model and says, well, okay, I'm going to go and sit in the library. Doesn't matter, I can't read a book. Kids will go into the library because I'm there. And so they did. And all of these young kids who would otherwise be, you know, hanging around on the streets were going into the library to hang around Neil. And then the librarian would say, hey, go read this book. And the kids are starting to read. This is, I mean, it's transformational in a community that was quite dysfunctional only months ago.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And transformational in his leadership and stepping up.
Yeah.
Yeah, for someone to initiate that, this wasn't anything anyone had told him to do. Yeah. He just saw that he had the capacity to make things better.
Yeah, he took it really seriously. And it's this, you know, self-pride and respect in his responsibility. I mean, these words just don't float in communities like this all that often. The most impressive part was the day that Neil couldn't make it into the library and when he'd gone and arranged of his own volition someone to come and sit in the library so that the presence had been maintained and the kids would still go in there.
So there's another cool kid in there leading the pack.
Exactly. And, you know, what more can you ask for? So this capacity building, you know, the criminal rates have gone down, the workforce participation has gone up, but importantly, the young leaders are starting to step up. and take the community on a path that we would prefer to take. Now, the military capacity side worked for us as well. And, you know, we learnt a whole bunch of lessons. And I coin it now as we were understanding how to understand. And 51 covers 70 recognised Indigenous nations. And to be honest, it's probably a lot more than that. And we know that even in what they deem one cultural group in Wudjil Wudjil is actually three clans. So that 70 could be 210, you know, for all we know. So I've got this diverse map that I need to work within to find my workforce. And just as Eileen pointed out, there was often not a word for friend. So we were just government, we're stranger. And it was because we didn't know how to penetrate the informal structures of Cape York. So if I talk human terrain, you've got your formal structures of a council and the things that you would normally go to in a metropolitan, say that's an authority. Then there's all these informal ones, and this is no different in any country I've ever been in. It's the people who are, you know, the shadow governors of Afghanistan, or in this case, it's the local tribal structures and the dynamics of the clans and the family groups and the elders. Mm. And until we identified through the most patient and beautifully intentioned people of Wudjil Wudjil, how to ask the right questions to get the right information, to be the trusted organisation we see ourselves as and take very seriously. So with the help of Eileen and the team in Wudjil Wudjil and the lessons we learnt there, we then went to look to apply them elsewhere, and my capacity grew significantly. So we had a sevenfold increase in our recruiting numbers, which translates to one in four in the battalion were recruited in a 12-month period.
That's impressive.
And 135% increase.
There's businesses around Australia listening intently to this now.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And our, you know, so one of our big traits is we don't believe in skin colour. You know, when you come to work in army, you come to work in green, and we welcome your diversity, and we want your cultural background, and we want your thinking, but we don't want your politic. So it's a Switzerland approach of everyone's welcome, but leave your baggage at the door, but share your story and share your culture. And in that context, we don't really measure ATSI, but it is important for people to understand. So we had a 135% increase in our ATSI participation in the unit, which was a direct result of understanding community and then being able to work within that. And there are many drivers, but I guess the message there is, our capacity grew as transformationally as the Wudjil Wudjil social capacity. Mm. And so then it became about preserving the gains and resilience.
Mm. Tim, you use a great phrase when we've talked before of understanding how to understand. Mm. And I'm sitting here, we're all sitting here listening to you and looking at you, and you keep talking about culture. And I spent a long time working in defence. It's not a word that easily comes up as a normal part of discussion about the workplace, but there is something extraordinary about culture. Eileen, you call Tim brother. You know, Josh is brother Josh. There's a family piece here, and then there's you joining the army. There's something extraordinary happening in terms of culture and both coming in to meet each other's culture.
Yeah.
And this seems to be incredibly important as well, as you've talked about community. How important has it been to be understood and also to learn about the other?
The biggest thing I've been impressed with is the change that I've visibly noticed. Like Tim and I, when this was all happening, we never yarned direct. It was because we were busy just, what's going on here?
You know? You're busy people leading big organisations.
So it's not as if we sat down every day and had a cup of tea, so how was your day? You know what I mean, kind of thing. So, but the big thing was by me doing the Army Reserve training gave me a better understanding about, like, Army culture. Because first time we were doing recruit training, even like how they would yarn, you know, we thought a lot of them were deaf because they talk very loud, you know, like when they
even
yeah, that kind. So we felt sorry for them, and then poor buggy deaf, you know.
You got a medical dispensation.
Okay. So we felt sorry for them, you know, poor buggers. But then since they've been working with us and know our ways, you notice it when we do parade. they drop their pitch, they yarn. So if Eileen isn't doing her turn right or she's out of, because I'm terrible for parade, you know.
This is just purely hypothetical.
Yeah. You know, you'll hear this little, you know, quiet sister, you know, gentle. And so that's important. And these mob here, like when they come to do parade and they come up on country, the first thing we do is break bread. Like, you know, Nanny Murray and the team will either make, you know, fried scone or damper because there's a bit of a competition on with the grannies.
Yeah. So Nanny Murray, yeah, of course, yeah, is one of your elders, yes, in the community, who's been a really important part of this, yeah, as well.
So, yeah. So, and, you know, watching big fellas, you know, like army hardened soldiers, you know, jump for this little 4 foot nothing woman, Nanny Murray, you know, and like very gentle with her, it just, you know, melts you because you think, okay, they understand, because they're not separate, they're family. So we've very much embraced them as family. And when we yarn with the other communities, like we tell them, don't touch them, they're family, they're us.
So I think you get that. You know, we talked, there was a nexus early with Kapani, and then we had this sort of double helix where it crossed back over again. And we built the capacity that we each wanted. And then when we looked at preserving those gains and you know, hardening it, giving ourselves some resilience, it was the inverse. And what I mean by that is, so from the military perspective, my ability to generate capacity was sustained because of the cultural awareness they had and the empathy that they had learned and the culture way. And there's no shortage of, you know, members of the team now spending their weekends with their families up in community, talking with cultures, like bringing everyone along this journey with us. And what we saw from the community side was their resilience came from all of this extra capacity. You know, when your workforce participation goes up like it did and there is less crime occurring, then there's more capacity to tackle the challenges of the future. And we go back to the start of there are some genuine challenges in Woodjal Woodjal with isolation and weather and climate change. And now there is brain space and now there is labour to start looking into those. So this crisscrossing of, you know, our lanes have now diverged, and I see resilience not in terms of preserving workforce numbers, but actually preserving our ability to integrate with community, to understand culture, and not, you know, not just Eastern Cape culture, you know, all the cultures on the Cape, and ask the right questions and understand and learn as much as I can, and then go away and be an advocate. And that's, I guess, when we talk, you know, how you can be touched by experience, and, you know, Eileen and I have been travelling around working in each other's hip, and we talk every week and we share ideas in a you know, purely innovative space, which is brilliant. It gives you hope, and that's a pretty powerful thing. And it also gives me, you know, an experience base to challenge orthodoxies and to challenge biases when I come across them. And, you know, when we talk about reconciliation, we talk about bringing the Indigenous community into Australia more fulsomely. That comes from education, and, you know, my team take their role very seriously. They're not going to agree with everything, and I don't think you ever have to. What you have to be is open to hearing and listening and understanding, and then apply your lens on it and form your opinions. Fortunately, you know, the opinions we formed are all positive, and we get to take that forward and carry this song line and extend it from Cape York down to where we're from and in with our families and friends and the other people we come across in daily life.
Yeah, it's been so for your listeners there, council is really, and community talk about five generations. We only want to be involved in programs and projects and that sort of thing that you know, help us be here for the next five generations. So, like, from a local government perspective, yes, I'm responsible for the physical local government assets, you know, water, sewerage, you know, road networks, that sort of thing. But in terms of cultural assets, you know, that's just as important. So how do you risk manage for that? And, you know, once the capacity was there, then I could focus on, okay, we know the biggest threat to us at the moment is around climate change, the big impacts we're seeing and we're feeling in a community sense. How do we protect our traditional hunting areas? How do we protect our cultural medicines, you know, traditional medicines and food sources, food security, energy security? So for your listeners, we're at the end of the line for everything, for comms and power, everything. So during wet season, food supply is a big issue.
Because the road gets cut off a lot, regularly.
So you know, in our spare time, what we've done is built our own weather station and river monitoring to start capturing that data, which is to Bureau Meteorology standard. We're then matching that to other traditional stories that talk about how the land had changed, you know, over the last 60,000 years. So the data we're collecting with that, we then also built our own Wi-Fi mesh dome as part of our emergency management network forum. So even when Telstra goes down, because I think Cook and all them mob were a bit sad when they came through. So we've got places like Cape Tribulation, Mount Misery, Mount Sorrow, Weary Bay.
You did have a pretty rough time.
Yeah. I think you can see a, you know, thing there. Yeah. But it's actually allowed us as a community to like, hey, we can do this. And it's certainly for me as a leader, it was the best thing I ever did because it's made me more fearless, you know, and we get told no a lot. You know, So for me, I smile and say, okay, next opportunity.
Yeah. And it might be worthwhile just noting here is, are we up to 5 national awards that Woodja Woodja Aboriginal Shire Council has won in the last 2 years?
Five months, so they've come to for
the projects that have occurred in your time as CEO. So pretty incredible. Can I just go back? We've had a really interesting discussion about this very humbling meeting of cultures and some extraordinary things that have come from both sides in this partnership. But we started off certainly out for Jay and me, we work in the security space. Tim, you came here and you still are in a commanding role for an operational unit that is on operations right now, undertaking surveillance and reconnaissance in Australia's north. What impact has this had on your capacity? It's a great story of capacity building led by Eileen and the community in Woodja Woodja, but what impact has this had on your operational capability?
Huge, yeah. I mean, there's so many ways to answer that question, actually. It's a cracker. Well done.
Huge is a good start to answer then.
I think we
might be onto something.
Huge, stop, discuss.
First and foremost, the numbers game. So the math has to underpin what we do. I need people to generate patrols to generate, you know, the surveillance effect. So integrating in community has allowed me, not just through Woodja but elsewhere in Cape, Gulf Country, up in the Torres, to be more effective at you know, speaking with community and building that sort of workforce numbers, which is part of it. The resilience part I talk about of in Yalanji, you know, the warble, you know, our hearts are more tuned to country way now. And being able to talk, you know, in language or at least, you know, stumble around it, we've become a bit more aware of how the environment impacts the sorts of things that we're out there looking for. And the example I give is, you know, one of the prescribed threats that we conduct surveillance against is the illegal exploitation of natural resources, illegal fishing.
A lot in the news in your area these days.
And you know, previously, you know, our schedule might be as sophisticated as saying on the 17th of August there's going to be the beach demersal season and so we'll get some patrols out there. And I was driving through country with Eileen and Nanny Murray and they said, this flower's in bloom. Beach demurs early this year. And I was like, haha, no, it's not. It's the 17th of August because my calendar says so.
That's tide and moon, I think.
Yeah,
or whatever, scientific measures of whatever.
Yeah, I think Kiki K or whoever presented the calendar that I was working on. and sure enough, you know, Nanny Murray and Eileen and the team were right. And it's one of those, of course, you know, the local environment is what influences the local environment, not some abstract thing like a calendar. So it's now trying to learn as much as we can about culture because it's putting us in the right place at the right time to get the right effect. And when you're an economy of force organisation like we are and resources are scarce, I can't be everywhere. So it's taking a bit more of the guesswork out and, you know, we've got the whole – you know, governments, intelligence enterprise sitting behind us, helping steer us in the right direction to be there, and it's been pretty effective.
So this local intelligence from Nanny Murray and Eileen on the Beche de Mer, What happened with that? I mean, were you able? Was it able to affect your ability to engage with illegal fishers?
Yeah,
this is a good story.
Absolutely, you know, it did put us in the right place at the right time for a bunch of things. And,
so you acted on it.
Yeah.
You ignored the calendar,
and now we know that. Again, it's this understanding how to understand, and we're like, you know, if once the elders trust us and they can see us as a safe place to share some of their knowledge, and not, you know, not exploit that opportunity, because there is a real issue about data sovereignty, and you know, should ask Eileen about this because she's a ninja at it and talking the lingo. But we don't want to be seen as people to take the sovereign data, the sovereign knowledge of the Indigenous Australians and use it for anything other than a just purpose. And so that is enabled by trust, and the sort of trust we've been able to develop on the Cape through being more culturally aware, more culturally nuanced, and much happier to work in community, because we are getting some, you know, instant reward. Every time you work in community, you walk out feeling better because you can see change, and that's always good. It's steering us in places that were available but we couldn't access, and it means now we can go to the right place at the right time to see the right things, to get the effect we want, use my resources better, create opportunity elsewhere or capacity elsewhere. It's a, you know, it's a whole process. Wonderful.
Mm. You talked a bit before, Tim, about resilience and obvious and the extraordinarily complex tapestry of relationships, Eileen, that you've got with Army now. Tim, your time in this role is coming to a close soon. How do you feel about how your part of this delicate partnership will go into the future? And Eileen, how do you see that this partnership, how it will continue?
Yeah. Sister, I think everything happens for a reason. Sometimes you don't understand, you know, like people who come on your journey may not be there at your destination. So you have to have faith in that journey. Brother's role is not ending, it's changing. So part of my journey then, even though I feel a bit sad, he's taking country with him to Canberra. I'll get a bit teary.
Well, can I actually say, so you've both brought country here to Canberra this week.
Yeah, it's been a blessing.
You've spoken at our conference to more than 300 delegates from around the country and around the world, particularly from our region, and had an impact. So,
So, you know, brother's role is now he takes country with him because he's been welcome to country, his family. For your listeners, our three clan groups are Gugu Yalanji, Gugu Noongal, which is Red Tree Kangaroo Country, and also Dalanjiwara, which is Sea Country. So he takes all three with him, and that's important because as a warrior for us mob, you know, he's got to carry that wawa with him down here, and his replacement we will welcome into family because they're family. So, you know, culture way is we've got to learn them the right way, and it's both, you know. So, it's going to be interesting, but that'll be a real test to us how we then – what's the next stage of the journey. But I think for us and me Googling you mob and hey, what do you mob do? I think it was Brother J.A. Rang you up,
Your phone, she calls me out of the blue and says, hey, brother, what do you do? Well, I work in a university.
Yeah, that's right.
But it started a long conversation that's got to this point. But you were right. You've reached out to us. But
so if partly to build that visuals then.
Partly to build that bench strength at another level as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and to capture what we've been doing, because sometimes we talk about there are storytellers and there are story keepers. Mm. And me and Brother Tim have been doing the story, like making the story happen, but it's not our story to tell, you know, to share in that security. That's your mob's gift, you know.
So part two of the phone call is Jay, and I'd have to say you called the right person because you've got it's about being receptive a bit as you both have been to your story. So Jay came running down the corridor to my office and said, I've just had the strangest phone call of my life. What do you think about this? And we had a talk and thought, well, we worked through and just said, well, there's a nexus to border security, so let's just see where this goes.
There's something here.
Yeah,
there's a journey, but there's more than just anything. Yeah. I'll throw in, I might ask you to just quickly think about if you think there's some lessons for others, because some people listening to this might think, well, this is a nice story, but it's about one small community, you know, a particular battalion with an unusual role in a remote part of Australia, a meeting of minds. I'm dealing with in a much more complex space. I look, for example, at countering violent extremism. Some of my friends are working with troubled communities or some youth that are at risk in suburbs, in cities, and they're thinking, well, yeah, you could control these things. You could do this. But what's the lesson for me? And I mentioned that CVE example because in the years I've been working in this, the holy grail of CVE is how do you bring together social cohesion? And while Jay and I looked at this and thought, yeah, there's a border security story here, certainly when we got there, I had an epiphany moment listening to you talk and thought, wow, I've been looking for social cohesion in all the wrong places of it, but I can see an example of it happening here. Mm-hmm. There's certainly an example coming into other areas. What do you think the messages are for others?
I think there are a few. I'll start at a military perspective. I'll work my way around. But from a military perspective, we know that the human terrain is the piece that we're most at risk from and we know the least about. And I think, you know, we're probably the least equipped right now to deal with. I had my team do a lit review for me and do some case studies and figure out what made a good trainer. A military trainer, and that's the sort of operations we're doing in, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq right now, in the Philippines and elsewhere. The three things they came back with were you needed to have a good IQ, you needed to have a good personality, and you needed to have a good EQ. And IQ and personality are relatively fixed. Not a lot of growth can be achieved despite training, but EQ is malleable. At the moment, there are a few things in defence that train EQ. And I would say that the lived experience of myself and my team in the 51st and the other RFSUs is an EQ shaping experience and a positive one. So militarily, there's real benefit in that. I think from a social perspective, there are lessons about adaptive capacity building and partnering. And this is maybe where I say the most general lesson that we can have is the opportunities are everywhere. And, you know, I've studied a bit and I've been around a bit, but the lessons of the last little while in particular, you know, that I've learnt from Sister here about, hey, nothing is insurmountable and great ideas come from just about anywhere. And we tend to be afraid to just take a step. And so think about the, you know, 68.9 hectare CEO of a council Googling national security and then just cold calling one of the directors of the National Security College of ANU and saying, hey, what do you do? you know, that takes some moxie. And that's not where it ends. You wait till you hear it talk about vertical algae farming, membrane technology, microgrids. It's not ending, you know. Yeah. And we have these wonderful conversations that I would never have dreamed I would have. Usually on a Sunday when Eileen's hitting the books or catching up on a reading and you get these innovative left-field ideas and it's like, yo, brother, I'm thinking about connecting with someone with Space Force. And, you know, if you'd have asked me that 2 years ago, I'd have said, yeah, okay, whatever.
And you're sitting here, so the ANU launched the Space Institute this week.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's not as silly as you might think to come up with these ideas.
My immediate
response
would have ordinarily been that conservative, you know, response of, yeah, you're crazy. It's flipped. And my immediate response now is, I mean, we can have a crack at that. What can happen? Like, we can just ask and they'll say no. But just as you've described, you know, of we went on this journey and we had our clear lanes and we thought we were operating for our own objectives and they crossed over at a point. And my progress now is actually furthering Eileen's objectives. My progress now is, you know, harnessing my warble, carrying that song line, supporting, you know, what I understand as culture way, preserving that respectfully. And Eileen's progression and the innovation and the resilience she's building in communities actually having that national security effect that no number of surveillance patrols could accomplish through the social cohesion.
You had the Chief of Army, General Burr, visit you recently, didn't you, Eileen?
Uncle Rick is deadly, I must say. He's deadly.
And I might just note Uncle Brendan Nelson as well holds you in high regard.
He's deadly too.
There was a request when you came down this week to see if you called to ask if you could go to the War Memorial just to offer up some artifacts from your security song line from the Bairds. And when I contacted the director's office, I instantly got Dr. Brendan Nelson is trying to clear his diary. He'll be overseas a bit, but he has all of this is everything he's doing. When can he see Eileen?
Yeah.
So there's something interesting going on here. Just ask that question.
So I think one of the strongest things was when General Burr came out. And so General Campbell had already been through community. And,
so Angus Campbell, CDF.
He was through. And we've had, Kath Campbell, the future Commander 2nd Division.
Mm, she's deadly too.
Brigadier. We've had any number of visitors come through. But we think back to that moment that Eileen spoke about where the elders of community, back when DV was high, and specifically around that, there was a trigger incident. It was really brutal where the lady nearly died. And they cried and they prayed. And you sit down with Nanny KK in community and she'll talk about it. She can't stop crying even now when she talks about it. And she goes, I wanted something to change and I didn't know what. And generationally it was about, hey, we need the army in here. We need the army in here. And the army's come through and community's done and we've all worked together and that was great. But as General Burr came through as Chief of Army and said, I am here as an individual representing the entire organisation. I'm in community with you and we are behind you. There wasn't enough Kleenex in Queensland for that moment. They've left a plaque in the council with language of, together we are stronger.
Yeah, standing stronger together, yeah.
And in return, he's got a whopping piece of art that now adorns the Chief of Army's office from community in Woodjill. So we've come full circle.
Mm. And I think it's, if anything, one of the journey I wanted to raise was just about having that Indigenous voice being heard around security, around innovation, around left field ideas. We're a different kind of clever, but we're not usually given the space to have that say. And then also what is the role of community, whether it's through local government, but it's mainly community, Sometimes we hear the term enabled. I will enable you to reach your full potential. But sometimes when you say that, it comes from a deficit model because you forget that they actually have something there already. Whereas this story we built on that was already there, but we had forgotten. So part of it was an awakening. And I guess it's starting, Army and I think wider defence now, security isn't something that happens in the shadows. And as we say back home, safety isn't just police business, it's everybody's business. Same with security and caring and love for country, it's everybody's business.
Well, that sounds like a perfect note to end what has been an extraordinary journey. Thank you for sharing this incredible journey and for the privilege, as I'm looking at Jay, of us being brought into it to at least be able to help tell the story and for sharing your wisdom.
Yep. No, look, it's been fantastic. I think the inspiration was clear when you shared your story at the Women in National Security Conference and widely reflected on Twitter, I understand, as well.
Yes, we did. We trended number one in Australia for a while. A couple of times at the conference, including when you were there.
Hashtag amazing.
Hashtag you're deadly.
So for a community that gets cut off comms-wise regularly throughout the year.
Yeah. You were doing pretty well on comms.
Pretty well. Yeah. Perhaps social media.
Yeah. Hey, I'd really like to thank you guys as well.
Yeah.
A lot of what we were doing we didn't understand until we had the opportunity to sit with both of you on a very bumpy car ride up into community some time ago. And it's been a brilliant experience in us now trying to capture the lessons and what we've done. so that we can use that as a bit of a guide for other people and distill some of the bigger lessons to inform policy and the way forward, which is what, you know, the National Security College does best. And so, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Well, congratulations to Woodjal Woodjal community, that your broad community and family, and the 51st Far North Queensland Regiment for an extraordinary story over the last 2 years, and may it continue on for five more generations.
Thank you, sister. And I just like to pay respects to for traditional owners for here, for Ngalawal mob, and the welcome to country that Auntie B gave us the other day. That was beautiful. And also the welcome to country that Nanny Murray received out at that healing farm, yesterday. Mob here have been very welcoming. So to any traditional owners listening and, you know, our elders, they're listening, thank you so much for listening and taking time. To those of you that haven't been up our way, just come. Just turn up. We'll find space for you.
And anyone coming to ANU, we have Jabal, Jabal Indigenous Education Centre. So we've got Auntie Anne Murray Martin, and we've got Asmi Wood. Very welcoming, who've also helped us all on this journey.
Yeah. No, thank you. Cool.
Thank you.
Yalada.
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 So that's it for the Women in National Security series. It's been a great week, so make sure to keep an eye out for another series next year. A quick reminder that we would love to hear from you about any of the issues we discuss in the podcast. You can get in touch with us by Facebook, where we are Asia Pacific Policy Society, on Twitter, where we are at APS Policy Forum, or just shoot us through an email, podcast@policyforum.net. I'm Gabrielle Knipe. Until next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.